So basically, my background is I was a practitioner in patient advocacy, trying to help people get access to healthcare, and moved into academia. And so I'm spent a lot of my career working in the system of healthcare and trying to figure out how to manipulate it, I guess, for my clients' benefit. I was also very involved in the Obama campaign because healthcare reform was a big part of that. And myself and a lot of my colleagues felt that he was going to bring a sort of sober focus to trying to move healthcare reform ahead. What's going on in the United States on the outside looks a bit berserk, I would imagine, from this country's perspective, with everyone screaming at you that you have death panels and everyone screaming at everyone else that we have death panels, and this notion that we must be barbaric because we don't have universal access to healthcare. And I spent a year in Italy, and everyone there kept saying, I don't understand. How can you not have healthcare for people in your country who grew up in your country? And so yes, we're a bit Wild West in the United States. That said, the problems we've got right now are not unique to us. They're expressed in a way that's unique to our system's problems and foibles in terms of our sort of perhaps excessive focus on individuality. We're not very much a communal focus in terms of a lot of our policy. But that aside, cost is raging out of control. Healthcare is becoming a huge part of the gross national product in just about every country that has any meaningful health infrastructure in place. Our problem with that is not entirely unique. People's ideas about what kind of healthcare they want in their lives has increased as both what we can do to enhance or improve people's health has increased, and as people have realized there's money to be made in this world, right? So we see an expansion constantly of what you can get, what kind of new medical technologies you can have access to, what will make you feel good, what do you need to feel good. At the same time, this brings up problems of what works, what kind of healthcare is actually truly effective, and what's really being developed merely to get money out of the system, right? And I just don't think those tensions are unique to the United States. They may be, but that's where we are. I was going to start with the structure, though, pre-reform of what the United States healthcare market looks like, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to people here who are not from the United States. So just walking through it, I basically describe it as a poorly structured series of imperfect safety nets, because you have no guarantee, right, you know, cradle to grave, that you're going to get access to healthcare. But we've got lots of little bits and pieces, and if you've got a lot of sophistication or you're just very lucky, you will be covered. Medicare was started in 1965, as was Medicaid. It's the program that provides healthcare to people 65 and over. To some degree, in England, you all privilege the young with a lot of resources in healthcare, not to oversimplify it, but a lot of resources tend to go towards children. In the United States, we privilege the elderly. I don't know why I wasn't born when we came up with this, but 99.1% of all of our elderly have consistent access to health insurance. Okay, to a third-party payer and a very generous series of benefits, and they're considered very powerful politically, which may be why we privilege them. I don't know. Medicaid is a federal and state plan. It's equally financed by both. It's basically health care for the poor. So if your income is a certain level below the poverty line, you're supposed to get access to health care. However, it doesn't really work that way. Right now, it's become more of a venue for getting health care for pregnant people, women, usually, and children. Some states, it's almost impossible for a single young man to get on Medicaid unless he's already had a terrible motorcycle accident or something like that. You know, in any realm of non-disability, almost impossible. In other ones, it's a little more generous. TRICARE and the Veterans Administration, those are for active military service and retired military people. They get access to a very sophisticated, very well-organized, cost-effective system of care. That doesn't mean it's the most generous, but it works really well. And we're starting to actually focus attention on them in a policy. Like, how are they doing that? How are they negotiating such good drug rates and managing to provide this care for everybody? And then they also cover all the family members of people in the military. Okay, the private insurance market is where the fun is. All right. It's employer-based, which is an historical anomaly. It came about because there was a wage freeze during World War II, where they said you're not allowed to pay people anymore because we think it's unseemly. And so they created all these benefits aside from your wage base. And one of them was very generous health insurance. Now, health insurance being generous at that time is well, there was nothing much you could do for people. So it just wasn't terribly expensive, right? We're talking World War II, and it wasn't really until the 1960s that we had this start of the explosion. Like, if you look at charts about what medical care costs, it sort of went 1965, 1970, you know, then it just went into the stratosphere. So it was a nice thing, but it's not taxed. All right, so it's a really rich benefit now, and we're going to get back to that when we talk about some of the changes. But it's also, if you think about it, a counterintuitive benefit, because the more well-off you are, the more highly trained you are, the more important you are to your employer, right? The richer the benefit you're going to get in terms of health insurance to keep you there, the more it's worth their while to give you this. So in effect, the poor are subsidizing the rich with this because it's tax deductible. You see what I mean? It's a significant income shift, in other words, where you know, you talk about the tax structure being used to allocate resources, it's being allocated towards the wealthy as opposed to towards the poor. It's didn't start out that way, but certainly the wealthy have not been complaining about that as it's developed. Most people in our country historically who are 65 and under, so in other words, who are not on Medicare, have gotten their insurance through their employer, right? But that's been decreasing as the costs have gone up, right? In that marketplace, a lot of employers have been dropping it or dropping it for families. That's where the children came who suddenly ended up on Medicaid, right? Their parents work full time, but they don't have any benefits they can extend to their children. So if you don't have it through your employer, what do? You go on the individual market, all right? Each state has its own marketplace run by its own insurance commissioner. This is not controlled right now, pre-reform, by the federal government, except in the most minimal way, and it's a wild west. It truly is. First of all, you have to go through an underwriting process. So if you have a pre-existing condition, you won't get insurance. All right, so if, for example, you lose your job and you can't fold right into another plan, and I'm not going to go into all the details of some regulatory structures that can help you, but it's not hard to fall out of that. So you have to go on this market. You're uninsurable, in effect. I mean, there are some pools that the states have, but they're extraordinarily expensive, and they have wait lists for years. And in these states that don't have Medicaid, you know, that you can get access to, we have a truly horrific problem. And with the recession pushing on sort of this poor web, right, that we've got a problem with any given year. One-third of all adults go through some period, 65 and under, go through some period where they don't have insurance in any given year. One-third. Not surprisingly, we have a problem then of not having insurance. The other problem we have, because of the lack of any regulatory structure in place here, with the increasing cost of the plans and people trying to figure out how to keep their employers covered, we have another enormous problem of underinsurance. So people think they have health insurance, but there are really high deductibles. There are caps, annual caps or lifetime caps. It would really shock you. I mean, you cannot get an organ transplant out of most of these caps and have it covered with the anti-rejection drugs through a lifetime. You're going to be lost. You're not going to have insurance. So the caps are very low. I mean, some are as low as $50,000 in a year. Even the most generous ones, I mean, mine is, I think, $1.5 million in a lifetime. Which, if you think about it, if you get a serious illness over the course of a lifetime, you could actually, or if your kids do, you've used that up for the whole family, and you're uninsurable at that point. All right, so far more than 50% of all personal bankruptcies in our country right now are directly the result of medical care costs, right? But into the high 80s, if you look at the way that the medical costs can lead to other problems that lead to the personal bankruptcy. So the big chunk that they studied originally was just, I can't pay my hospital bill, I'm going bankrupt, right? And that's at least 50 to 60%. But if you start expanding it, I lost my job because I have to take care of my loved one because he doesn't have insurance, right? Or I took out loans to cover the medical costs so I couldn't pay my mortgage, that sort of thing, the numbers go higher. We're taking a huge hit, in other words, in terms of productivity, people not getting access to care, losing their jobs, losing their homes, just this big problem. I don't think it's that way in most European countries, you know, that spillover. But as you start trying to figure out what to do about the rapidly increasing cost problem, you're going to be making some choices. And I think more than anything, you should look at what we've run into as an object lesson of where you don't want to be. There's a lot of talk, particularly in the European Union, free markets, let people do these choices. China has shifted from universal care to letting people purchase health insurance. They're going to start running right into the problems that we've got, and they've got even less of a safety net than we do in a medical infrastructure. All right, so we have all this, and we say, well, we have a problem, right? What else can we do if you can't get health insurance. If you can't get care, do we really have people dying in the streets in our country? You know, like your image of Calcutta 100 years ago or something. And so our former president said in this lovely statement, I mean, people have access to health care in America. After all, you just go to an emergency room. This probably didn't register to you guys, but I have to tell you that a primal scream was heard from just about every health law professor's office when this went out. I know it's a little wonky and inbred, this world of people who care about health regulatory structures, but this was so obscenely ignorant about the problem we were dealing with. It was just kind of stunning. So the law is called EMTALA, and this is our catch-up. This is like our, we don't want a tragic situation, so we're gonna have a law. It's called the Emergency Medical Care and Active Labor Act, okay? And basically what it is that if you're bleeding to death and show up at the door of an emergency department in the United States, they must stabilize you. If you're there and you're actively having a baby, they must deliver that baby. Let's say you've got some gruesome tumor and it starts rupturing, they stitch it shut and send you home. All right, they don't have to cure you, they just have to stabilize any life-threatening illness. They don't like doing this, right? Because you show up without insurance and they want to dump you, they want to get you somewhere else off of their potential cost sheet, right? Because this can be incredibly expensive, but they must do this and there's a lot of fines on them. What happens here though? Do you magically go under EMTALA and get treated and everything's fine and we've solved the problem? Absolutely not, because first of all, you still get billed. They can take your home and your car and attach your wages for the rest of your life to pay that they so happily gave you, right? Number two though, even in South Carolina, which is a very poor, very small state where I work, there's more than $750 million in unfunded emergency department treatment in every given year in the United States, thanks to EMTALA, just in that one state. What does that do? Insurance rates go up, right? Everybody's got to pick it up. The hospitals can do less direct charitable care, less research, less management of their own resources because they have this huge unfunded mandate, basically, requiring that they cover this stuff. If we can move people more into an insurance pool, in other words, we have this sudden win that hasn't been talked about a lot, that the states are very cognizant of. Okay, so what is the primary focus in the reform here? First of all, why do we have it? What is the moral or ethical justification for this? You can have a lot of different ideas about it. One of the nice things about just about every, I mean, not all, but just about every ethical theory is that at least it's not opposed to the idea of caring for the sick. Notions of justice would say, right, that we want people who are similarly situated to be treated the same. One of the hallmarks of the American healthcare system right now is what I said, luck, randomness. You're not treated the same when you're similarly situated. You could get treated so differently in one state versus another based on their Medicaid programs. What kind of employer do you have? You could work very hard and have the exact same education, the exact same background, right? And you either live or die based on a lot of things that are completely outside of your control. So justice clearly calls for some sort of change. Then you have probably most properly, you know, with most people agreeing with it. The UN statement about human rights and access to health care, you know, they came out with a series of statements about how important it is and how what a affront it is to basic notions of human rights to not have that, and that certainly motivates a lot of people, the sense that somehow it's just wrong for a community to not be providing health care to its members, to people who are within its boundaries, that somehow it's inhumane to a very high degree. It does something wrong to human beings, that they have an entitlement, in effect, under a rights-based notion to get this. But whatever your reason is, whether it's very budgetary, you know, I want to harness the efficiency of everyone in my country, or human rights based, or whatever, what is it that we need to accomplish? So the first thing we want to do, right, and I think just about everybody in health policy agrees on this in our country, we want to increase the size of the insured population. I mean, ideally, from a rational allocation perspective, we would have one pool. Right? And this is sort of actuarial talk, but I'm pretty sure everyone gets this idea. You take a certain amount of money for every single person from the second they're born to the second they die, and you put it in a pool, right? And that's the way of spreading risk, a community-based risk-spreading process. In other words, and that's basically what you guys do here to some degree. I think it's divided up by region to some degree, right? They distribute the pools around. But that's very efficient. Everybody sort of buys into this communal notion. You don't have generational battles because you view yourself as, you know, being entitled to what you need from this pool throughout your lifetime. we're not remotely close to that. At this point, we're just trying to hope if we can get more people at least covered in insurance, we can change things, right? It just seems like everyone can agree on that. We want more people insured. We also want to create a more efficient system. When I was talking about this explosion of what's available out there right now, you know, we want to figure out what works. What's the most efficient use of our money? Where are we going to get the most effective bang for the buck? This is something, obviously, the people in England have been spending a lot of time and energy trying to figure out. There are different ways of doing this. You can talk about comparative effectiveness, where you leave cost out of it. You say, you know, we have finite resources in terms of trained medical professionals, for example, or time or access. How do we figure out what best to spend our energies on, right? Which kinds of treatments, for example, would be most effective? Or you can go right to cost-benefit analysis. We have, you know, and you get into the whole issue of qualities and stuff like that. What is a good outcome? How much are we willing to spend for that good outcome? If you're truly going to do that, you have to have a stomach for something. You have to be able to look someone in the eye who has a diagnosable and treatable illness and say, you know what, as a policy, we're not going to actually fix you. And it's a very, very difficult thing to do away from policy theory, right? To actually look someone in the eye and do that takes an extraordinary communal commitment on both people in that conversation's part, in effect. You know, you have to feel like the process is fair, that you have some say in it, or else it's really going to lead to a lot of civil unrest and anger, I think. It's just not easy to impose that kind of system. We are not remotely close to that. So let me make that really clear. We're not. So we want to minimize the cost of fraud. We're realizing that with this scattered system of all different payers and all different ways and all different money makers involved in it, a huge amount of money is being wasted paying for care that's never actually been provided. It's kind of embarrassing almost when you think of how structured it's supposed to be with bills and payments and all that stuff. But think about it. You have insurance. It may not be very good insurance, but you have it. You're sick. You go to the doctor and you get this thing in the mail. This is what happens in the United States. It's called evidence of coverage or a benefits payout. And it's like the sheet, and it's got codes for all your illnesses that make no sense, and they don't actually translate them into what happened to you, right? So it'll say CBXY127349, $195 charged, $120 billed. You owe $19.95, and you go, okay, this makes no sense to me. I think I can afford $19.95. I don't feel good, and you don't look, right? That is where the fraud is happening for the most part, because you could put tons of charges on there that never happened, right, that you never saw the patient for, that they never received, and they're not going to police it. They have no incentive to. Does everyone see this? It's just, it's a problem. It doesn't explain everything, but it explains enough to be a bit embarrassing. So within healthcare reform, there's been a big focus on trying to do that. And then you have this directing funding resources towards the most effective care, which I was talking about. Okay, so how do we increase the insured population in the plan we've got right now? You would think that we would just pass universal health care. I don't know how much people here heard about the public option. Did that get talked about here to some degree? There was this idea of creating a public option, maybe a federally funded plan that people could choose to buy into. And everyone thought, well, that's code, because obviously they'll do it better, it'll be cheaper, and everyone will shift over there, and it'll be the end of the private insurance market. Why didn't this fly? And I'm going to talk a little bit about the politics of this, because I think it matters in terms of how it's shaped. And it's really hard to tell the story, to be honest, without talking about the politics of it. Clinton, through his wife Hillary Clinton, had the healthcare reform attempt in the 90s, and it was prescient. The number of people who were opposed to it who have said to me in the last 10 years, God, I wish we had that plan now. It was really quite high, but they anticipated problems that were going to happen. So that's the first thing. This is reactive. It's not anticipatory, which I think helped it to some degree. Second, it was enormous. I mean, this act in and of itself is a couple of thousand pages of legislation, but the Clinton one was tens of thousands of pages of legislation. It was basically trying to get every detail controlled by the legislative branch as opposed to being done through the administrative branch. So you could fight about so much. It looked like this enormous, intrusive, complex regulatory structure that was coming down. But the third thing that they did that I think led to the failure was, in our country, there's a historical alliance. Hospitals, the American Medical Association, pharmaceutical companies, and insurance companies tend to have their interests aligned. It's a very potent lobbying force to have to go against, right? Not only do they have a lot of money and a lot of power, but they represent a significant percentage of our gross national product. You mess with all of them, you're messing with jobs for hundreds of thousands of people in our country, the retirement accounts of hundreds, the health insurance if they lose their jobs of all these people. This is not a small part of our economy. So you have to tread very carefully when you're looking at sort of dismantling that entire system. But besides that cost, you have this juggernaut that's almost impossible to break. So what the Obama administration did that I thought was fascinating was they came up with plums that split the juggernaut. They came up with things that were so attractive to one part of that group. And so as I go through some of the things, I'll say, now this one this group loved, and this one this group loved, and it worked. All of a sudden, you saw the heretofore unbeatable group fighting amongst themselves, paying their lobbyists to kind of try and play with the details in the bill instead of standing in opposition against it. It was phenomenally successful. And some people have complained about some of the laws when they were being written, saying, why is this giveaway to the insurance company in this law? And I would say, because we're not going to have a law unless we have a giveaway to the insurance company. It's simply not going to happen structurally. It really depends on your stomach for the horse trading that's necessary and how much you just desperately want us to get to the point at the end of having some sort of meaningful reform occur. My stomach for the horse trading is pretty high because that's the way our country functions. It's not like I like it or it's my ideal world, but I was just impressed they figured out how to do it as cheap as they did, to be honest. Okay, so that's sort of the political backstory. So as we go through some of the things with reform that may not make a lot of sense, I just want to highlight, I think some of this was to get the political will going forward to actually pass this. So the first thing they did was they increased Medicaid eligibility. Remember I said that's the thing for poor people? They said up to 100, and I think it's 40% of the poverty line, everybody's allowed on Medicaid. Okay, we're not going to push people out of this, right? And the other thing they did, which is fascinating, is they matched Medicaid reimbursement rates to physicians to Medicare reimbursement rates to physicians. Now, Medicare is the program for the elderly, right? It's politically very powerful and has very generous, comparatively, reimbursement rates. So you go to the doctor for something, if you take the Medicare rate, you're going to do all right. You won't get as rich as some things, but it's good. And as a result, many, many more doctors take Medicare than take Medicaid. By doing this, it was very interesting. Coupling of interests. Does everyone see this? They suddenly took this political juggernaut, Medicare people, and hitched what are historically very powerless, the poor in our country, right? Hitched their wagon to Medicare. So if you want to argue about cutting Medicaid reimbursement rates, suddenly you're running into one of the most powerful interest groups, the elderly, right, in our country. And we haven't seen this one play out yet because they haven't done the regulations, but it's going to be fascinating because you have this identity politics that's going to go all wrong unless they change the law. But does everyone follow what I'm saying? It's just, it's a fascinating, very under-commented way of tying this together. And then the federal funding for the increased Medicaid eligibility for about 10 years, the federal government's going to pick up the tab for that, and then they're going to gradually wean the states off of that. Then we had mandates. All right, now mandates have gotten a lot of attention in our country. I don't know how much they've been talked about here, but basically it's, you got to get insurance, and if you don't, you have to chip in some money. Why is it we'd say you have to chip in money if you don't have insurance? It's because of EMTALA and Medicaid, because we don't leave you bleeding by the side of the road, right? If you get that serious injury, you will be treated to a certain degree, and you could justifiably, particularly as a young adult right now in our country, you could decide, there's no way I'm going to get insurance. First of all, I have to go through this pre-existing condition hoop. Second of all, it's incredibly expensive. Third of all, the likelihood of me getting sick is very slim. So I'm making a calculated risk. And if something catastrophic happens, I'll go on Medicaid. I know the hospital will treat me under EMTALA. I know that Medicaid will pick up the care for me until I get on Medicare. It's a very sensible decision. Does everyone see that? I mean, it's not necessarily the right decision. And I personally am very risk averse. I could never go without insurance. But that may just be because I study this all the time. But for a lot of people, that's what they do, and it makes perfect sense. They may have trouble getting access. This changes the calculation. Do you see that? It says you're going to have to pay some amount of money, first of all, to carry your share of that rare chance of a catastrophic risk that you expect us to pick up. But second of all, they do something funny. They say, to increase the number of people who are getting insurance, we're going to pay for your insurance. We're going to pay on a sliding scale up to 400% of the poverty line in our country. You're going to be getting some contribution from the federal government. So in fact, let's say you're in graduate school. Let's say you're an American in law school, as I happily got to tell all my students. The government's going to pay for your health insurance in a private plan now, because there's no way you're working enough hours, at least under our rules, the law school to be earning the amount of money to get you out of this federal subsidy. Does everyone see this? And so you gotta really not want health insurance at this point to be a young adult and have to pay that penalty, because the government's really gonna be kicking in a lot of the cost for it. Then what do we do? So we have this mandate program, and it's got the carrot and the stick, right? And in a lot of ways, it's really trying to balance the risk, the cost that your risk represents to the pool, right, by making you pay that penalty if you don't do it. But it's really to push people to get health insurance. Then we change the individual market, because, you know, just saying there's a mandate isn't really going to make this problem of the impossibility of getting insurance go away. So when the act is fully in place, at least in theory, you will not have any more pre-existing conditions that limit your ability to get insurance. The insurance companies will not be allowed to exclude you based on pre-existing conditions. Another thing that's interesting is they won't be able to rescind your policy. That's another sort of sweet thing we have in the United States, where if you have an individual plan and you get sick, they investigate your initial underwriting application to see if maybe you fibbed. And if you did, they yank the plan. They only look if you start costing them money, but they can rescind it back to the day that it started. And there are investigators who get very intrusive trying to find out if there's something. It may not be related at all to the illness that you have that they're trying to get out of paying. Let's say a sinus infection or something like that that you once had that you never thought of reporting. So what, right? But if they can blow that out of proportion, they can say this show's lying. Lying is grounds for rescission. We rescind the contract. You no longer have care. That's going to be much more difficult to do. I still think it's going to be possible to do. I don't think the law is written as strongly as they're saying it is, but at least it's going to limit it. Okay, so we have pre-existing conditions, rescission limitations, help paying your stuff. I think of what else. There's so many small little tweaking changes they've done to the individual market, but the whole point really is make it easier for you to get insurance while we're pushing you to go do it, right? We're trying to fix that issue. Okay, so what are we doing about efficiency? Remember I said we want to increase the number of people who are insured, we want to increase the efficiency and the quality of the stuff. So there's this idea that if we could get a system where everything was electronic, where you had control over your own medical records and where they're communicated at lightning speed from one doctor to another, a lot of extra tests wouldn't happen, you'd have more control over your own medical care. In this great world of efficiency, we would do a better job. And to some degree, intuitively, it's correct. It requires the right stuff to be put into the system for the system to have the right stuff in it, which is human error, and that's an issue. And they're finding that's a little more prevalent than they had hoped it would be when they're studying places that have already moved towards that. But there's an enormous amount of money that's getting flooded in to do this. This is what triggered the death panel stuff, by the way. You'd think it was triggered by something else, but it was this. There was this idea that if we had this system, the government must be planning on taking all of your medical records. And since they've got them all, I make us sound like a bunch of paranoid lunatics. If it's all there and you can get access to it, they'll start going through this. And so the idea of a death panel, which I've had to explain to so many people in Europe, because I think you all think of it, I don't know, I want to ask someone, what did you think it meant, the death panel thing? Like a panel that decided what kind of care you got, right, across the board? Like elderly people should not be entitled to cancer treatment if they have less than 5% chance of survival, something like that, right? That's not what the blogosphere was saying. That's not what Rush Limbaugh, and hopefully for you, you've never heard of him, but he's one of our more well-known conservative commentators, what he was saying. The idea was, using these medical record systems, the government would identify every elderly person who needed healthcare and would make them come in person to stand in front of a panel and justify their individual care. And then the panel would decide whether they could have that care or not. Then the panel would have the power to punish doctors who did not do what the panel said, did not report the patients to the panel, et cetera. This was so extraordinarily complex. And when you think about the resources that would have to go into it to hold one of these hearings every single time somebody needed medical care, I don't know what they were thinking, but that's honestly what they thought. But then they kind of tried to back away from that as everyone sort of laughed. And so they said, no, we mean this as a metaphor. It means rationing of healthcare for the elderly. But this is what really set it in motion. So the other changes in reform are towards billing and the fraud investigations that I mentioned. Right now we have a system where it's diagnostic-based billing systems. So you get a diagnosis and we say, okay, that costs about this much to fix. right? And so you get the code. That's that code I was talking about. It's this high art of how do you code illnesses. And if you're really good at it, doctor's offices will pay you a fortune to come work there to do the coding for them and the billing. It incentivizes certain kinds of behavior, right? And it could be based on very poor scientific evidence about what kinds of things we want people to be doing. When it was put together, we weren't nearly as sophisticated about evidence-based medicine, in effect, and what the effect of payment systems are towards what we don't know, right? We can be pushing people towards things that on the surface look intuitively like it makes sense, but we can be doing everything wrong. And so there's a lot of funding in there to try and make the billing system more rational, to make it go towards incentivizing proper behavior. For example, our system is fractured. Right, it's very difficult to get doctors to talk to each other unless you're lucky enough to end up at a place where they're all working in the same building. And so we're upping the payment for primary care physicians for management of complicated illnesses. It used to be you couldn't get paid for that. If you spent a couple of hours, well, you can't right now. You spent a couple of hours trying to figure out what your patient really needs, where they need referrals, reading the records that came from that doctor. You didn't get paid for it. And someone said, wait a second, this makes no sense. We need people doing that. So what they're doing is they're setting up pilot programs in a lot of the things I'm talking about. They've put money in to give states a grant of $50 or $60 million to try and set up an experimental program to see if they can make this more efficient. Medicare will be doing this too, like changing its billing practices in different areas to see if they can get the information. So the effectiveness. There were three proposals for comparative effectiveness research, and this was the second half of the death panel. Okay, so you had the electronic resources and the comparative effectiveness issue. I've gone over my time, haven't I?
Welcome to another 10 minutes or so.
All right. So basically what happened with comparative effectiveness is this. There was this idea that you can't head on confront rationing of healthcare in our country, that it's undoable, right? And so the way to try and get around that is to create a process that's protected from the political process, where someone can make a decision, a panel, let's say. And the way, and I'm partially to blame for this, and I don't even agree with it anymore, and so it's I wrote this article on Medicare that they gave me some funding to write, where I came up with this whole proposal for this sort of naval board, because we couldn't close naval bases. And we came up with this really Byzantine, politically protected system to generate names of bases, and it was really, really hard for senators from those states to block the closing of the naval base. So I said, well, why don't we do the same thing for Medicare cost effectiveness? You know, just make it as Byzantine as possible, protect it, and have sort of these things come flying out of there, right? That it's really difficult to fight back from the political pressure of the different stakeholders, right? I now totally oppose this, by the way. I think it's like totally anti-democratic. It's against informed consent. It's terrible. It was my first article I wrote. But anyway, that's what they created. I'm sure it's not my fault. I was just expressing, I think, the common wisdom at the time, let's say, I hope. But they've done this, and it may work. Basically, it's so weird. It's a panel that if it looks like Medicare's costs are going to go up, remember that's the federally funded program for the elderly, it looks like it's going to go up, they make a recommendation for a way of cutting costs so it doesn't go up a certain amount. If the Senate does nothing, the recommendation becomes law, okay? If the Senate overrides it, it triggers a budgetary process where they have to justify the increase in spending, which is very difficult to do under certain budgetary rules in our government. You have to justify every cost. You have to sort of make it cost neutral for many of these kinds of laws. You have to go through this huge process for the cost that you're suddenly having to allocate for the extra spending that the committee said we're gonna do away with. Is everyone involved? This is Byzantine, but it's interesting. We'll see if it actually survives. We're not very good at that sort of thing. But the other thing they're talking about is generating this comparative effectiveness information through a different panel and getting it out there for patients and doctors to use, and it's fascinating. The idea, I think, is that we need, for this to work, we're going to need a population-based buy-in, in effect, of demanding a certain level of effectiveness and justification before undergoing any medical procedure. And historically, we haven't done anything remotely like that. And honestly, we haven't done any education to get people to feel like they're part of that system or part of that decision-making. And in the last 10, 15 years, we actually have a schism of public trust in this kind of scientific data that they're being told. It's been manipulated for a lot of political reasons, been manipulated by drug companies to promote sales, et cetera. And so there's not a lot of reason for people to trust this kind of information. But if we're going to generate any savings, the way that healthcare reform is structured right now, we're going to need that kind of buy-in. You know, we're going to need individuals. And I don't know of any structure, any country, that uses that as the baseline for generating cost savings. I mean, most people try and systematize it and centralize it as much as they possibly can. This is the exact opposite. So it's going to be a big experiment to see if it works. And that's it. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Jack, do you want to field your own questions or chaired?
Field away.
Questions?
Well, that was easy.
Because I think part of the discussion was, well, there's lots of good things in here, but actually it doesn't come into effect for a year, 2 years. The government's going to get out eventually. Who's going to pay for it then? So,
well, it's a very, very complicated question. I actually didn't even go into that part of it in the talk. The law is seriously a couple thousand pages long, so I was trying to just hit the highlights. What they've done is the law itself, different sections of it are going to go in starting in September, the first things, and then through 2016, roughly. Okay? So there's going to be implementation across that timeline, all right, for a lot of these. Some of these study plans are for 5 or 10 year pilot plans, and so we're going to be seeing that funding go extending through that time, too, and the results coming in. The part that's, remember I said that the Clinton plan was very legislatively driven? This isn't, okay? It was written by the legislature as opposed to the executive branch. Because in Clinton, the president basically wrote it, but then asked the legislature to pass it. This law, the legislature wrote it, but they're asking the executive branch, through its administrative power, to fill in all the details. All right? And that's where the huge fight is happening right now. And it's a fascinating dynamic, if you're interested at all in how these things work, because they have appointed one of the most powerful heads of that federal agency. It's Health and Human Services. This woman is a former governor, but she's also a former insurance commissioner for her state. I've never seen someone with that kind of background step into that. And she is taking on insurance companies. It's a delight to watch. I've never seen someone, I don't mean to sound biased. I'm sure they're very good people and all. But she will stand up and say, without any federal law backing her, this is disgusting that you just did X, Y, Z, and you better change or I'm going to find a way to make you suffer. And then they fall. It's really fascinating. So she's going to be a really interesting part of how this gets fleshed out. She's running the administrative agency that will write the regulations. That will really, because if you're a lawyer and you hear a lot of what I'm saying, you're going to say the devil's in the details here. How do you define this word? How do you define that word? And she's going to be defining them. So we'll see.
Roger.
A couple of naive questions. The first one is why we should think it's a problem that the proportion of GDP being spent is so high. Because if that's what people want to spend their money on, then why shouldn't they? That's the first question. And then the second question is, it's a bit like the question that you got in Italy. Can you explain the American mindset? So on the one hand, people don't want to have universal health care, but on the other hand, they don't want to leave people to die in road accidents. How can they make
Let me answer them in order. The first one, the gross national products, it's not so much that it's too much. I actually don't believe that it's too much. A lot of people say it is, and they point to it and kind of freak out. I'm like, whatever you choose to spend with expanding notions of what healthcare is, it's a very elastic concept. The problem with the enormous amount of gross national product that our healthcare system represents is that when you go to change it, you're risking the stability of our economic infrastructure. That's more the problem. Do you see what I'm saying? It's a problem if you feel we're spending too much on healthcare too, and that number represents that kind of problem. But the other problem is we're in a recession, we're not very strong, and if you upend this, we don't know how many unemployed we're going to get. We don't know what's going to happen to our stock market, that kind of thing. Because there's other things going on besides healthcare, and the executive branch has to be cognizant of that. You know, and I think Obama actually said that in his speech. He said, I don't want to go to universal healthcare right now. We're too delicate financially for me to risk messing with that part of our economic sector. And the stock surged of those different companies after he gave that speech. So it was smart, unsmart. As the American mindset, boy, we don't have one mindset. It's it's a very individualistic country, but it's also very compassionate. I think we're kind of schizophrenic. The way I see it is more, no one at least has had the nerve in a debate I've been in or in a political environment to say, I like people hurting, right? I want people to be sick and not get health care. Everyone says, you know, in an ideal world, everyone's going to get the care. The question becomes, are there other policy issues or value commitments you have that are more important than that? So in the United States, a lot of people feel, for example, it's critically important to have government kept as small as possible. All right, that while they want health care, if the best health care could come from government involvement in it, their commitment to smaller government is actually more important to them on a moral scale than their commitment to providing that health care. So to them, it is a suffering that they wish wasn't happening, and they hope we come up with a better way of getting it, but their prior moral commitment, you know, to this small government tends to trump it. So that's more what I run into with that. But there are a lot of people in the United States who want universal health care. It's not by any means, I think it's probably a bare majority want it.
Most people don't want it supplied by the state.
But most, when you got 51%, you've got who votes, who has the power, what are we doing to the existing economic infrastructure? How do we undo the situation we've got in right now? That's why I was saying all that stuff about the political power and the different interest groups. Just having that majority isn't enough, in effect. It's not like we have a constitutional amendment, you know, that everybody's voting on, and if you get that group, it's done. It's a much more, I'm in awe, in truth, and I've never said that before about a legislative program, but that the Obama administration managed to move us this far, even with all the things open and imperfect in it. Was it different than mine?
It was remarkably similar.
Really?
Yes. I don't know whether that's remarkable or not, actually. But one thing that I just wanted to ask you about a concentration that he had that you didn't was he made a big deal of the sort of programs of billing. And his analysis was that the vast majority of costs incurred in the healthcare system come from complex cases, and that large part of that problem is about the billing. And so he was very excited about programs that would rationalize the billing and take sort of complex care packages, take the cost of those down. That's what I just wanted to say something about. The other thing which I just wanted to say a little bit more about was the last slide. And as I understood the last slide,
this one?
Yes. So you talked about two different systems there. You talked about sort of
panels, yeah.
You talked about the sort of Byzantine panel set up, the naval, based on the naval thing.
So there's the Byzantine and the Anodyne.
Okay. So it seemed to me that the sort of nice equivalent is the Anodyne one.
Byzantine.
And, is that the Byzantine one? Okay. Because I wasn't quite sure how that connected back to the Senate.
That's the one that makes these recommendations, right?
Right.
To reduce the cost of Medicare. If Medicare's costs go up by a certain percent, it triggers their power to make these recommendations, right?
Right.
And then if the Senate does nothing, the recommendations become law. That's what Medicare does. It reduces, for example, it rejects coverage for a certain new procedure or something like that, according to those recommendations. If the Senate overrides it, if there's political pressure on the Senate to override the recommendation, they have to go through this really complicated procedural justification, which I think requires a supermajority, by the way, like a third of two-thirds of the Senate, to vote approval of adding that money to the budget. So it's very, very difficult.
Okay. And then that's separate from the other system, which is
these recommendations. It's supposed to help fund research into comparative effectiveness and make recommendations for patients to enhance the quality of their care.
So that's the bit that Zeke was saying is like nice, but will actually work, which I was puzzled about.
I really support Obama, okay? And so what I'm about to say right now must be taken in light of the fact that I don't think that much of this is really political. It's very policy-driven, but the political realities of the situation require putting things a certain way. This stuff is not going to save the kind of money that they're claiming it will, okay? It will save some money. Of course it will. We've got a ridiculous system. That whole series of nets obviously has redundancies and waste, and one of the focuses on trying to reduce that kind of administrative spending will have a huge effect. But no, they've had to justify the Congressional Budget Office numbers that were being put forward of the cost of the bill to the Senate. You probably didn't follow this that closely, but they kept trying to say this is how much it's going to cost from this supposedly neutral body. So they've really exaggerated the potential cost saving. I'm not saying they don't believe it. I'm not saying they do, because I don't know, you know, but realistically speaking, no. And when you increase this kind of coverage, it will cost more money. You're giving more people health care. It's a good thing to give more people health care. And to get it passed, they had to claim it was going to save money. I mean, you got to give Palin some credit, okay? Because she actually stood up and said, you're talking about expanding health care access to 30 million people, but I don't want those 30 million people getting health care because I don't want to pay for it. I don't want it on the backs of the currently insured. She just said it. And it's like, yeah, you're right. We're expanding access to those 30 million people, and we will have to pay for it. Do you see what I'm saying? And we can hope that we can rationalize the system so that going forward, once we have sort of absorbed this initial cost, we don't bankrupt ourselves. I don't think that's necessarily pessimistic, you know, to say it's going to cost us a lot of money, because we'll be accomplishing something really good and important. But I respectfully disagree with Zeke on that. It's been illegal, arguably, to consider the cost of medical care when Medicare is making its coverage decisions since Medicare was invented. But cost has been explicitly considered when making the coverage decisions that Medicare has been making.
Okay.
All right? So, and everybody knows that. All right? Like if you represent a drug company or a device manufacturer, you are playing this as hard as you possibly can. Right? You're trying to hit that sweet spot where you get FDA approval and the broadest possible coverage decision by Medicare by not offending their pricing. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, you've got to come in with the data that'll sort of, it's a game where a lot of it's unspoken. Kabuki. There, I'm using all sorts of strange metaphors. It's like a kabuki play where everyone knows what's going on, but no one admits it. You know, it's all silent and fans and things. But I hope I didn't offend anybody. I've just seen a couple of them. But the point is, no, it doesn't explicitly let you do it yet. It's this Byzantine structure is not confronting head-on the problem. It has this noise, and some of this is going to depend on what the regulations end up being written and how far they push the actual language of the legislation. But the other panel, the one that's about patient advisory, is hamstrung from the beginning. The way it's written, it's clearly put in there. It is not to be used for coverage decisions. They're not to be used as evidence of malpractice by doctors who don't comply with them. They put this stuff explicitly in there. So everything you would want it to do in a system, right, where you're trying to control it, has been stripped. It frustrates me because I want them to be honest, you know, and at least let us have a democratic discussion about it.
Janice.
Yes, I didn't understand the situation before, and now I don't understand it at a much more complex level.
No, I made PowerPoints, though. I'm sorry.
No, it's just amazing.
But it's endlessly fun to work in.
Right. One of the things that always worries us from this angle, I mean, there are hundreds of things that worry us about the American system, it seems to contain an awful lot of perverse incentives for doing unnecessary procedures if you're a doctor because you'll get paid for them. And there's a remote chance that you'll get sued if you don't. Does the efficiency improvement address that at all? Giving people lots and lots of tests.
It may. And a lot of this, again, is going to depend on patient education. All right? We had this thing where this board announced that, you know what, you don't need to go get mammograms as often as we thought you did. And I was like, yay. Because who wants to go get mammograms as often as they originally said you had to? But the backlash against it, I think, was evidence of this, what I'm describing as a profound distrust, basically, in the data. people are being told, unless people start getting information that they actually believe is valid, it's going to be very difficult for them to tell from a patient perspective, right, if they're being pushed into unnecessary care. In terms of the policing of the government, I don't know. It could be, again, with the regulatory structure that they're creating right now, that they'll manage to get some power. But the laws as written do not, in my opinion, explicitly make sure that that's going to happen.
And of course, we have that problem the other way around. This is as soon as anybody tries to say that it's necessary, there's more of a demand, mammograms, mm-hmm. there's more of a demand for the state to provide them because they don't trust.
Well, this is what happened. I mean, in our country, basically, it got to the point where everyone now is running out and getting mammograms constantly, it seems like, from what they're saying in the news, you know, twice as much as they ever said, because they're defiantly protecting their right to get mammograms. This is about the role of public health, too, right? Public health loves education processes, right? And in our country, they've been, I'm sure they are here, too. They're ones that catch on. They become remarkably effective. And then you suddenly say, oh, I'm sorry, we are changing our recommendations. And people freak out because they know that they go get this test done this often, and they're good people. And they're the ones who can say, I don't want to pay for those people who make poor lifestyle choices when they get sick. That's what they say in the United States, right? I go get my mammograms. I go get my this. I don't smoke. I don't do this. And they get very pious about it, as though sickness is really that fair. And so people cling to it. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. I wish I could give some sort of answer. It would be nice, not part of the pun, it would be nice if we had more rational decision-making on all sides. Doctors truly are terrified of getting sued, though. It's almost funny in our country how they've kind of boogeyman the whole lawyer.
Well, it's not culture. Surprising. I mean, I've taught at American law schools, too, and we're educating so many lawyers that they all have to find employment.
That's true.
Ask you a question, Jacqueline.
Yeah.
So you mentioned briefly the failure of the Clinton attempt to reform the healthcare system in America. And my understanding is that there were previous attempts sort of throughout the 20th century to reform the healthcare system that didn't work.
Mm-hmm. Since 1917, every year there's been a proposal for universal healthcare.
Right.
Yeah, in our Senate.
So, I mean, there's sort of two kind of related questions that come up here is, well, how come they keep failing and how come people keep trying? this is, again, it's an American mind question.
I know, I feel, I am not qualified to speak about the American mind because there is no single American mind, okay? There are a lot of people in America who agree with me and a lot of people in America
right.
who think I'm Satan, and it's just, it's hard to,
yeah.
And I'm not terribly political, to be honest. I mean, I am, you know, about Democratic policies about other things, but about healthcare reform, no one has clean hands in our system. They've all taken huge amounts of money from both sides. So I'm not going to point at any particular saint. Why has it failed and why do they try? They try because a lot of people really want universal healthcare, and it bothers them to have people not getting care. It bothers them, and you get someone who hears a horror story and they're suddenly aware of this and they move forward. I mean, we have one senator who did it himself, though, every year, so he really cared. I mean, just having one motion every year doesn't mean there were a lot of people doing it. The World Health Organization ranking us so incredibly low in countries a few years ago certainly didn't help.
How
you know,
low
and,
exactly?
Oh, it's 32.
What does the public mindset say about the fact that Cuba has the same life expectancy?
Mine's right.
I think it's kept dark.
Okay, you asked me what America says, and it's really funny because my immediate default position are the crazy radical conservatives where I teach. That's not America, though, and you know, a lot of them change in the course of my class. You know, they come in. I do this mind game thing, this exercise in the beginning of my class where I say, okay, you're driving down the road and you see this guy in his 20s, and he's smoking a cigarette, and he's riding a motorcycle, and he doesn't have a helmet on, and it's raining, and he's wearing flip-flops. Okay, and he's going really fast down the highway, and he's focusing on keeping the ash of his cigarette dry as he's zooming along, and he crashes. What do we do for him? And everyone's like, nothing. We do nothing. And I say, well, do we at least send the dead animal cart? Right? Are we going to scrape him off the side of the road so we don't have to look at him? And so reluctantly, the hand, yeah, we'll scrape him off the side of the road. Yeah. And I gradually move them towards maybe we'll give him a leg. you know, maybe we won't leave him to die, but we're going to hate him for it. And then I do a counter one, you know, the brave mother working three jobs who gets pregnant with her second child and suddenly goes into preterm labor, and she's going to deliver this baby that's going to require neonatal intensive care for all this time. 10 times as much money as that kid's leg, right? And she's our saint to them, right? And they're throwing all kinds of money at her. And then when I start saying, well, do you want to pay the taxes for her or for his care? You know, when people change, depending on the question you ask them, I guess that's my roundabout way of saying that, you know, we're very uneducated about thinking about these hard problems in our country. It's not something we've put a lot of community resources into.
Just a point on this idea of the American mind. No, because there is more of an American mind than you think. So one of the things, when I was in graduate school in New York, one of the things that I used to take great delight in is pushing my American friends as hard as I could about their political system. And there was always a point at which everybody would crack. And that was the point at which I started, where I started questioning freedom. Right? And so you talk about the two different minds, that there are the people who don't want to pay for healthcare, and the people who do.
Well.
But so there are the two minds. The thing which I would have thought is the American mind is that the two minds are good. That's fine. That's about freedom and liberty. And that's the thing that we care about, is allowing people to have these different views. Whereas I think in other countries, perhaps this country, perhaps Europe more generally, there's a limit to the sorts of freedoms that you're allowed to have. And that in these countries, you can have any view that you want, but there's going to be some point where we're going to make a decision and you're not going to have a say. And so it's the value placed on the differences between people's views and their freedoms to have different views that's different, rather than. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, in conversation that's true, but in reality, no. We have a very, very limited set of freedoms in our country that we live within. And it's very, very structured.
Well, I understand that's the reality, right? The reality is that, but the sort of values that people ascribe to is not like that. Right, so
but the people who are, say, that if you accept the two minds theory, and the people who are of the mind that they want universal health care are really appalled by the people who don't.
Yeah.
So it's not that they're just saying, oh, it's good that we have freedom. No one denies that they should be able to speak their minds, but they're still absolutely appalled. I mean, the social opprobrium is there, it's just that it's extremely polarized. So
there is more commonality.
About that is different. It's in the system and it's in the expressed values about the willingness of the system to actually stomp on other people's views.
I think that a lot of people in our country would agree on what we admire and respect about the American ideal. Without saying that's the world we live in, it's more what we like to think of as the greatest things our country can be, and those values are uniquely individualistic, right? We're strong, we're individual, we're free, we can say what we want, we have a right to, you know, set our own path in our lives. These are considered uniquely American values. But there's this great essay that a colleague of mine actually wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine, What American Values? Right, where he just says, we haven't done the work, we can't use this phrase anymore about healthcare. Because we just haven't done it. We don't know what they are. Everyone loves to say it and conjure up sort of whatever boogeyman is in the back of someone else's heads about what they mean by that phrase. But we don't know, and I kind of share that. I'm not trying to avoid answering the question so much as saying we're a deeply compassionate country. We do very badly at turning our back to someone in need who's right in front of our face. That this is just true, how we do things. You know what I mean? Like the person standing and saying, I need an organ. Everyone gives them money to try and get it. You know, or people will suddenly donate, you know, testing to see if their bone marrow matches and stuff. We're very responsive. We're also very apathetic. So, you know what I mean? Who are we? It's almost like a teenager with strong passions on either side. We're the teenager compared to your country age-wise, and maybe that's a fair description. There is a lot good that goes on in the American medical system, and I don't mean to say that there isn't. There are a lot of people who get cured. It's not handling the stresses of the last 20 years well. And so the quality of care is going down. The access to the care is going down. And sort of in summation then, I mean, the move towards reform is trying to address that, to increase the access right across the board and to try and get some agreement as to what we actually want to be doing for these people when they're sick. One thing I didn't mention is the huge problem we have with chronic illness and how our model just hasn't adapted to fit that. You know, it used to be you got sick, you saw a doctor, you were done. But now we've got people who are going to need 30, 40, 50 years of intensive interaction with different levels of the healthcare infrastructure. And so some of what Zeke's talking about is that. Like, how can we, and so I think the word, the catastrophic illness is maybe wrong, but what we're really worried about is how to manage the extraordinary cost of chronic illnesses. And in that way, they do have some really good money-saving ideas of reshaping the system, but not just about money, more effective outcomes.
Okay, does anyone have any final thoughts they want to share? Janet, you look like you've got a...
No, it's just that there's so many.
I really adore this stuff. So thank you so much for giving me a chance to talk to you about it. I'd love to hear your questions later. Thank you.